From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. David Adair is an internationally recognized expert in space technology spin-off applications for industry and commercial use. At age 11, he built his first of hundreds of rockets, which he designed and test flew. At 17, he won the most outstanding in the field of engineering sciences from the United States Air Force. At 19, he designed and fabricated a state-of-the-art mechanical system for changing jet turbine engines for the U.S. Navy that set world record turnaround times that still stand today. He is a world-class presenter, keynote speaker, seminar and workshop leader, and consultant. His presentations include some little-known facts and anecdotes from his involvement with the space program, commercial technology development, films, and the things he has seen in Area 51. Welcome to Coast to Coast. Hi, David. How are you?
Hey, how you doing, George?
Good. Good to have you on the program again. Hey, when you started building rockets as a kid, were you doing it with those kits, or did you just make these from scratch?
Actually, I started off from scratch, and I was fortunate enough to have all the infrastructure and support that would really allow me to build liquid-fuel rocket engines, and that was because of what my dad did. And my dad was a coal miner in West Virginia, and I was born in Welch, West Virginia. As a matter of fact, if you saw the movie October Sky,
Oh yeah.
I was born 3 miles from Homer Hickman, and Homer's 14 years older than me. And if you remember the movie, there was an elderly gentleman in a black suit that his Homer's dad was the shop steward and foreman, but the mine superintendent he had to report to. Well, that mine superintendent was my grandfather.
And small world.
It really was. And matter of fact, when Gordon Clark was producing the movie, he contacted me and he says, I've ran into your story. I don't know which one to do first. I said, well, Homer is older than me, so age before beauty. So I said, why don't you just do his story? And which was a terrific little story. But to answer your question, my dad was he was gifted in mechanics, and so he opened his own garage, and there was a man coming through one day, and the car broke down. And my dad was a little tired that day because he would work sometimes 3 or 4 in the morning in the garage. He'd put blankets over the windows, and he'd tune up these big Chrysler 396 Hemi engines, and in the trunk of the New Yorker, they had a 250-gallon tank. It was moonshine. These were moon runners.
Ah, okay.
So they had to hide the lights because the revenue was looking for garages working at late at night.
That's why you had the blankets there.
That's right, to hide the lights. So so Dad had to learn to work very quickly and get done quick before revenue was come by. So the man had a broke-down car, and so the guy, he had a very elaborate carburetor back in those days. They don't even make them anymore, called Spicer. And they had a water jacket built around the carburetor. It's a very elaborate system. And so my dad changed that thing out in about 20 minutes. And the guy said, my God, do you work always this fast? And the dad said, well, I could be faster, but I'm tired right now. So the man said, well, I'm from Detroit. I'm on my way to Daytona Beach. It's 1954. And he said, we're going to start racing down there. He says, I'd like for you to work for me as my mechanic. He said, could you do that? And he goes, sure. And this man's name was Lee Petty.
Oh, wow.
And of course, he had a son named Richard. And
sure.
So my dad became Lee Petty's mechanic. And I was 6 months old, and we ended up in Daytona, Florida. And we were there for about 2 years. And then they built the big Charlotte Motor Speedway, and we all moved to a place called Randleman, North Carolina. And that's where, you know, we were there for quite a while. So what I had available was a big NASCAR machine shop, and by age 12, I overhauled my first 426 Chrysler Hemi engine, which won a Grand National.
How did you learn that?
Well, my dad, you know, I had no choice. By the time I was 9, I was putting these engines together, and I was learning how to run the shears, the lathes, the rolls, the press, the honers, you know, all the hardware that goes to build these things. And because we had drag racers there as well, our metals were like aircraft aluminum, stainless steel, titanium. And then we also, because of the fuelies of the drag racers, our fuel was methane, nitro, liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen. And so if you look at this shop and look at a NASA rocket shop, they are mirrors of each other. Both shops are designed to produce speed. And so when my engine won a Grand National, my dad said, boy, wait till we tell everybody about it. And Petty's going, Fred, we got a problem. We got this thing called a child labor law, and they get upset about this stuff.
Yeah, we
got
to hide this kid.
Yeah, so we really can't say anything, Fred. You're going to have to keep him in the shop there. And so they came over to me and said, well, God, Dave, we feel bad about this. Is there anything we can do for you? I said, could I have the shops at night? And they said, you got it. So I had everything I needed, and the first rocket I built was it was a single-stage cryogenic rocket, and, man, it left the backyard in a ferocious hurry, and I incinerated the entire backyard.
How tall was the rocket?
Now, the rocket was about 5 feet tall.
That's a good size.
And it weighed about 145 pounds, and it clocked out at about 3,500 miles an hour, and we reached an altitude of about 40,000 feet.
That's incredible. So solid propellant?
No, liquid fuel.
Just all liquid then?
Yeah, it's all liquid. Yeah, you don't. If you had solid liquid combined, you'd have a hybrid, which they have built hybrids, but I was pretty happy with just getting a solid fuel or the liquid fuel going. However, the solid fuel, I guess I used both. I did use the Estes rocket kit.
Yes.
And
those were fun.
They were fun, and what they were great for, I'd launch them like the micro midget. I would send up to get great altitude, and they come down with streamers. And I would use the streamers to judge the wind direction so I could start figuring out.
Smart.
Yeah, where I could start figuring out wind drift and stuff, because these things, I don't want a 145-pound rocket coming down on somebody's house. So I'd have to really plot. I got really good where I could drop it within a quarter of a mile where I was in any direction.
Well, I used to go out to a park to launch my little Estes rockets. You would do yours from the backyard, for crying out loud.
Oh, yeah. Well, those rockets are fabulous. Matter of fact, what happened was when I first saw, the first one I saw come out on a kit was the Honest John, and which modeled after the intercept rocket of the Army.
Yeah.
And so I built that thing and I launched it on a wind for wind streamer. And I looked at it, and I thought, well, this is kind of neat, but this could be fixed, and this could be fixed. So I wrote a whole letter of what needs to be done on some of the rockets and mailed it to the place. And I get this phone call from a man named Vern Estes.
Oh, sure. He was the founder.
Yeah. And you know what he was before he did this rocket? He was a real estate person, and he made a lot of money in real estate, and then he always wanted to build rockets, and he started a rocket manufacturing thing, which made more money than real estate.
Oh, he turned it into a hobby. And now, I think, David, I don't think they're able to launch rockets since 9/11. Is that true? Because I've been told you can't sell the propellants and you can't ship them. Now, I don't know if you can still pick them up in hobby stores or not.
Right. Well, you can still get them. They're still doing they cut back, you know, you have your Class C and Class D. The Maxi D.
Right, the D's were the big engines,
right,
more powerful.
Right, back on them,
okay.
And the only people who can use them, if you have a thing called a grandfather's law, will let you have it. If you have a Class C license, like I have, and you can use that, you can still get the big stuff. But trying to get that today after 9/11 is almost impossible. But I've had mine since 1967.
So what did old Vern want when he called?
He's a really cool man, and he... he says, son, I like that letter. He goes, you really pointed out some things there for us. He said, could you do that again on some other rockets? And I said, sure. And he said, well, could I send some rockets to you? And so I said, sure, and I'll write up a letter for what you would need on it. And let's see, I am 12 years old at this time.
All right, and did you have to build them out of the kit, or did he already send them already made?
No, I had to build them in the kit because in that process I could find some other things.
Okay.
Streamline stuff, and... but the thing is, he sent me a couple of everything in the catalog.
Oh, what a kid's dream, huh?
Oh,
it was,
man,
Christmas
going,
for you.
I thought, well, and he sent all the motors for them, too. And I went, now this is really good. I said, I've got all the wind streamers I need, and all I can do is write up some tech letters on it. And so I sent back, and so when I sent him back the letters and everything, every time I sent a letter back on a different rocket, man, here come a check for a couple hundred bucks.
You're kidding.
No, so I'd be... I suddenly became a paid consultant as well.
At the age of 12.
He was just a really nice guy. And then I told him, I think I hurt his feelings a little bit because when he asked me, well, don't you think these things are impressive and use them for everything? I said, yeah. And he goes, well, they're real handy for what I use them for. And he goes, what do you use them for? Well, I use them for wind direction. And he goes, well, what? For wind direction for what? And then I started telling him what I've got. And I don't know, may I? And then, well, he ended up flying out to where I was to see me because he had to see these things.
That's a great story.
So, yeah, and he was a very nice man.
I used to love waiting for the mailman to show up.
Yes, sir.
With my package.
And you know, back in when I started, sales were slow because nobody ever saw anything like that. And so what I did at my school, I started a rocket clubs and started teaching other kids because those rockets are excellent teachers because just like a little Cessna 150 has to fly on the same principle as an F-14 fighter.
That's right.
So
that's
with
right.
this little rocket, I could teach these kids exactly the same things that I'm doing with the really big things.
You know, David, our careers have such a parallel to it because
really?
when I was about your age doing that too, I had a rocket club going.
Cool.
And what I did with my friend is he and I would build these rockets from Estes, and we'd launch them, and he would be responsible for putting in the solid engine and
okay.
sticking that little wire in there and hooking up the electrodes.
Make sure your rocket hook is
yeah.
onto it.
And I figured if it went off accidentally, it's poor old Gary, not me. And what I would do is I would broadcast the launch to all the little neighborhood kids who were there. And funny enough, I grow up by going to broadcasting.
I was going to say, man, there was your death.
And you know what he did?
What?
He ended up building the space shuttle engines.
Oh,
how about
God.
That? I mean, so as a kid, Vern Estes touched us all in some way.
You know, they should do a really big biography thing on him, like on E Channel or something like that, because I think single-handedly, a former real estate agent did more for science education than probably anybody else has ever lived.
I bet then you must have had an incredible passion for science and rocketry.
It actually, unfortunately, went beyond that. It was more like it was obsession to a point where you wouldn't have probably liked me back then because I was so self-absorbed into it. I was terribly introvert and
I would have wanted to play a little baseball and football once in a while.
Yeah, well, I mean, I was just consumed by this and it was around the clock and it evolved. It was just a whole series of evolvement that everything kept getting bigger and bigger and leading to the next level till finally it led up to the really big engine that I built.
Did it get frustrating for you when you would come across a problem, some kind of technological problem, and maybe you couldn't fix it, or maybe you did fix it, but it took a while?
Oh, absolutely. that was every day. day and night, because I was moving along at such a clip. I was constantly running into problems, solving problems, creating problems, then having to start all over again and trying to solve them and learn to get to the next step.
How did you end up at that young age of getting into the Area 51 area? How did that happen?
Man, this is I told the story to Art Bell. It took us 7 hours to get through this story. It's so deep.
Well, great, we've got three.
I know, and see, the problem, the only reason I agreed to even go on air with Art.
Art did a seven-hour show with you?
I actually did one that was 70.
He must have chopped it. He did one seven-hour show?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That was my first time. I remember we went from like 11 o'clock till 6 in the morning.
That's, wow.
And he just was flabbergasted, I guess, with the story because the details were so intricate because it's an evolved thing. It's on a chronological order. It's on a timeline.
Right.
As you live it. And so as we kept going and going and going, there's just more and more and more. And the only reason I agreed to telling the story, he was willing to go that long
sure.
if it was that interesting, and it was. But the reason why, if I do short versions of it, the criticism just goes through the ceiling because the credibility is full of holes because you haven't had time to explain everything, how it all happened.
Is it that far-fetched to some?
Not, it is, yeah, it is to everyone if you get just a capsule version of it. But once you sit through hours of explanation and once you see how it layers, just like a movie, it layers with characters after characters and people involved. I mean, my God, when I got rolling, I'll give you anecdotes from it.
And we're going to save you a few hours of criticism, because if you were a kid and you did the Estes Rockets, you've got to be okay in my book.
Oh, I appreciate that. Because it was not easy doing that stuff back then, because, you know, the rockets were just coming out, and that was a very unpopular subject. Do you remember what's going on? Vietnam, baby burners, war mongrels, and being that age with everybody being hippies, I mean, it wasn't the coolest place to be in at the time.
And well, that's true.
And I've had to battle my entire life with all this stuff, but, the thing with, gosh, I'll try to do a short version here.
I mean, how did you get there?
Well, here's what happened. I had the machine shops, and that was in North Carolina. My dad was injured in an accident in the garage that really took him out for really working anymore. So he retired, and we moved to Ohio, and that's where it all started. I was in sixth grade then, and my dad still retained a huge machine shop that we built away from the house. And my dad decided that's the place to put me, because he told my mother, he said, if he ever has a mishap, we'll just go out there and there'll be a hole where the building was, rather than having him in the basement and he'd launch the entire family house.
With us in it.
Yeah, that's what he said. So we built this really, it was an old service station that was huge, and that was had a big big work base and everything. We closed it all in and it became a big machine shop, and I had a full bathroom and kitchen facilities, and I put a bedroom in, so I lived there. That's where I lived.
That was your place?
Yeah, that was my place, and I was about 150 yards away from the house, about a football and a half field away, and So that's where I did all my work, and the thing was really handy with all the machinery and all the tools and everything we needed. And then we did a lot of modifications, because I built a static test stand with a rolling door in the back of the building where we could roll it up, and I could test fire the engines out the back of the building. And that was real handy. And so there's the facility and the knowledge and materials are now in place. So I go at it and I'm working, but the next thing I need is I need a place to really launch things on a more regular basis. So since we were in Ohio, it's a very large farm there, and we lived our property was on the edge of a very large farm, and I had met the farmer, and there were four farmers, and if you could imagine like a big square with a cross in the middle where you have four window panes, each of those would be four farms. Well, these four farmers, this was 1966, and in September, Star Trek came out. And the weirdest thing, all these four farmers became hard Star Trekkers. So they saw what I was doing in that machine shop, and so they put me dead center of where all four of the corners of the properties would meet, right in the center of the cross of their properties. So they dug a big earth pit.
They give you your own little launch pad.
Yeah, I had a launch testing ground that was square miles in all directions.
So, David, you're in the middle of this acreage where four farmers have said, okay, you can have the middle and have some fun at it.
That's right, and it was more than acreage. It was square miles. And that was significant, because I needed a bigger area, because I was going to go a lot much higher altitudes. And so the farmers dug this earth pit, and with an earth ramp that you could drive a vehicle down into it. It was big. And I was set. So now I had a launch silo pit, and I had a missile receiving ground. So, and it was all privately fenced, and I was in good shape. So off we started, and the rockets came out of there just fine, and the only audience I had was herds of cows. There was lots of cows. Some of them were cattle people, and the cows were they're pretty cool things. They they learn patterns very quickly, and so that I'd be working down in the pit, and I'd look up, and the whole rim of the pit is surrounded with cattle. And they're looking down and they're watching me, and they're chewing their cuds, and they see me walk out real slow. They would all turn, and they'd walk a couple hundred yards out, and they'd stand and watch
the launch. Watch
the launch, you know. If they see me turn and run out of the pit, they would turn, and they'd all would run at the same time.
Something's wrong,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, because they knew there was going to be something bad, like a fireball, an explosion, which there was bunches of those, unfortunately. But so we got into a good pattern. Everybody knew what was going on when I did the launching. So the rockets would come out of there, and I had to be careful because I had to call the local FSS station, the flight service stations. I had to find out where the flight vectors were of commercial airliners.
Oh, yeah, you didn't
know.
Then
I would have to get a timetable and find out, since we're in a rural area, there wasn't too many of them, and I had to just find the time the flights were going and calculate exactly when there was nothing in the area, and then I could launch. And I'm sure every once in a while they got a spike on their radar and something comes streaking through there, and they probably wonder what that was.
You're responsible for probably hundreds of UFO reports.
Well, you know, what I did with the mixture of chemicals, I was able, with the cryogenic fluids, you know, as you go higher and higher, the temperatures vary drastically. When you get up to 30, 40,000 feet, it's almost, it can be anywhere from, you know, zero to below zero.
Oh, yeah, of course.
So what I would try to do is create a fuel system where the mixture, when it would come out, would try to leave almost a pretty much clear vapor. So it wouldn't crystallize in the cold air. In other words, it wouldn't have a vapor trail. And so you couldn't see the rocket. So,
But wouldn't you want to see it go up?
Well, I could. I had a tracking system. I had built my own tracking system from off the shelf stuff, and I had my own radar scope and everything, and I could just track my own rockets. I knew exactly where they were, and these rockets were guided. They were guided missiles. They were not just ballistic missiles.
You're a miniature NASA.
Well, in a way, I guess it was. It was just more necessity than anything.
Yeah.
I built jet evaders inside the thrust vanes, and these thrust vanes were radio controlled, so I could actually steer the rocket. And then I put spring-loaded canards in the upper part, so when it would go after apogee and come down on perigee, the canards would spring-load out, and I could steer it with the canards on the way back in. So I could make sure it gets right back to where we're going. Then streamers would come out to break this the speed down, because, man, you could hear them cracking coming back. It'd crack in the air. You could hear them for miles. It was they were going faster than speed of sound way back.
It's remarkable.
So then the drogue chutes would come out, and then the main chute, and it would just land, and we'd I'd get in a
go and get it.
Yeah, I'd get in a tractor and drive over and pick them up with the flatbed wagon or the trailer on the back, and it was Dr. Goddard all over again.
Did you ever have a strange landing, David? Did it ever land on anybody's house?
No. I never had any problems. I was really good at wind calculation stuff. I kept it all within the fields. I never had any mishap on landing. It was the launching that was,
Did we have some rockets blow up, David?
About every other one. But I got the only really bad explosion I had was, which led to a nickname that stuck to me like glue. But what happened was I was working on a cryogenic upper stage booster. Now, this is a two-stage booster, and it is very complex. To give you an idea for comparison, took NASA 30 years to perfect it. Soviet Union never did.
And you're trying to do it in a matter of weeks?
Weeks and months. So I'm going to have some problems. And the first ones come out where the upper stage wouldn't ignite, and the first stage got it up. And so I just had timing problems. But, boy, one of them came out, and it was a problem because the first stage goes off. The thing comes up, and as soon as the rocket gets to the vent horizon, which is the opening of the pit, as soon as it gets there, the second stage ignited, blowing the first stage back down into the pit, which all happens in milliseconds. That explodes. The fireball ricochets off the floor of the pit, back up, hits the second stage, and flips it on its side. And now it is a torpedo going across the ground.
Just all over.
And that's bad enough. I don't know how far this thing's going to go, but where it was going was the problem. It was heading dead center into the herd of cattle.
Oh.
And I'm going, oh, my God, save me. The cows were going to bite. So about that split second, the rocket is skipping across the ground. And about the third skip, it skips and nose right into the earth. And now it's vibrating with such a fury, it ruptures the tanks and then explodes. Well, being hydrogen, hydrogen rises above the ground. It has to get to a perfect specific point, and then it ignites.
Then it goes, yeah.
Right, so the fireball went off, and it was about the size of a school bus, and I could look underneath it, and I could see the face of the cows looking at me, and their eyes were about the size of plates. And they all in unison. It was just amazing how these animals did. They did an about-face, and it was a stampede. And that wouldn't have been so bad, but on the far end of the other side of the herd was one cow looking in the other direction. And it didn't see this herd coming, and it just disappeared. So I took off running, and I got up to the cow, and it's dead. It's mangled. It's stomped to death. And it's a big cow. These are expensive cows. And I'm going, oh, my God, I just got this cow killed. And I felt so bad for the cow. And here come the farmers from all four directions from the barns. The farms, and
I bet they're not too happy this time.
Well, they were
concerned
at first because they knew that was unusual, and they first asked me if I was all right, and I said I'm fine. But I told them, I said, I don't think this cow's doing too good, and they looked at it and went, oh God, it's dead. So they tell the farmhands to go get a front end loader and pick up the cow.
Oh yeah, that's the only way you could get it then.
Yeah, well, it's middle of July, so it's really hot. So the farmers told me. Get in the truck. We're going back to the barn. I thought, oh, my God, I'm going to be kicked off the property. So I've lost my launch site. So we get back to the barn. Man, they told me, just stay right there, David, by this tree, which had a big block and tackle. And I'm sitting there going, my God, what's going to happen? So they bring the cow up, and they hook a chain around the cow's neck, and they hoist it up. And they said, it's so hot, we don't have time to go to the slaughterhouse. David, you're going to have to dress this cow.
Oh,
and
God.
I'm sitting there going, I looked at him and I'm going, what in God's name would have wanted to put a dress on this cow? And they all bust out laughing. About that time, I hear this ring, ring, and the small chainsaw. And they give it to me, and oh, my God, I have to split this cow, and I've got to reach in. And it's just step-by-step directions they're giving me, and I'm doing everything I can to do the perfect job. But, man, I'm turning every color of the rainbow. And the farmer came up and asked me if I wanted a chaw of tobacco. That was it. I'm losing groceries. And so I still keep, skinning and hacking. And finally, I cut and draw and quarter this beef into sections, run it through their bandsaws and everything, and wrap it up, and it's done.
And so this was your new career as a butcher?
I guess. Anyway, they told me, they said, that was a... They were looking at the cuts, and they're going, shit, it's better cuts we've ever seen at any of the processing plants. And someone that dad pulled up, and I thought, oh, man, he's going to be mad. And they went over and talked to him, and I see they're all laughing. And I went, okay. So dad comes over and goes, well, I understand you now are a slaughterer. I said, yeah, unfortunately. He goes, well, it's pretty good because they gave us half this cow, which that's a lot of steak.
That's a lot of steak, a lot of money in those days.
Yeah, and I'll tell you what, I never ate a single bit of that cow.
I don't blame you. I don't blame you. Probably had little pieces of rocket shrapnel in there.
I'm telling you. But anyway, the women there, great needlework and, the quilts and things. Anyway, the wife of the farmer that owned the cow, she made this, embroidered this baseball hat with a name on the front of it. And it had speed on it, but it's not like speed of racing. It's short for stampede.
Stampede.
And so that was my name, man. It was speed.
And that followed you for a long time?
Forever.
I got to tell you, your mind to create whatever you touched was just remarkable.
Well, it was. I don't know about that. I think I was mostly just a crazy most of the time because trying to deal with this stuff, and that was the problem.
And now this is still Ohio, right?
Yeah, this is all happening in Ohio. And what's happening with my rockets, though, these are just all this stuff are just, all these rockets and all this flying and everything is just prototype research. It's all, and that's what it is. It's all research. I'm going somewhere with it. But in this process of research, I entered a couple of my rockets and science fairs, and I won everything.
Well, of course you would. I would think corporations.
Well, that's what happened. Yeah. I swept all the way to the Nationals, and boy, what happened was Dow Chemical was interested in what I was doing with the combination of fuels to break the vapor trails down, because that could have been that turned out to be a key thing for the military was interested in.
Were you mixing your own fuel batches and
absolutely
things?
Absolutely.
How did you know the right proportions?
Well, remember I said earlier we were in a race shop with drag racing.
Yeah.
And so I learned from those guys what proportion ratios that would feed into the...
What burned better and everything else.
Blowers, when the 1150 blowers on the top of a big 426 Chrysler Hemi engine, these guys could achieve up to 5,000 horsepower in a burst. And so... I learned all I could from them, and then I just I read constantly reading. I read everything in the library that could be gotten, and then the librarians would order books for me constantly.
And you didn't have a computer then, David.
Are you kidding? The math I had to start in. Oh my God, the math was starting. That was the thing. There was in the middle, the core feature of this whole thing is the math, and that's what's making everything work. And my math is getting more and more and more complex, and I am now, at this point...
And how old are you now at this point?
Let's see, I'm 13, about 13 and a half. And now I'm already into differential quantum mechanics, and that's when, because I'm heading into a fusion nuclear reaction system, which is what I'm looking for. And so the cryogenics are giving me the data for flight status, and I'm testing certain various materials and prepping everything else for the next level of rockets. You know, a lot of people ask me, you know, how do you know how fast that thing could go and how high it could go? You know, NASA has millions of dollars tracking equipment. You're just a kid. How do you know? This is just a bunch of BS. Oh, really? Well, let me tell you how it works. All you got to do is get yourself a 36-inch piece of wood, and like a corner molding stripping, screw in two little eyelets like you put latch door screens in. Those are your peep sights. Buy yourself a little plastic protractor, you know, the little half.
Oh, yeah, thing. Yeah. They cost a quarter in those
days. That's right. Glue it on a board, then take a nail or a little fastener and fasten the stick right dead center into the center of the protractor and tighten it where it can pivot. Then mark off 500 feet with a tape from the launch pad to where you're standing. That's a cosine of one in trigonometry, so it makes calculations very simple. And then you stand there with a stopwatch. You detonate the thing. Off it goes. You track it when it hits perigee. You look at your protractor, look at your stop clock, and I'll tell you exactly how fast it's going and how high it went.
Yep, and you were probably close right to almost the button.
I was every time, and it cost me back then about $3.60 to build the device, and NASA spends millions of dollars at the same time getting the same data that I'm getting.
Same thing. Right. Same thing.
People just don't get it. They think it's so complex, you can't do the stuff. You got to have these big, massive facilities. That's because you got labor and unions and job security. And if the actual science of this stuff can be done in a barnyard. And how in the hell do you think Dr. Goddard and Herman Obart,
see,
and Von Braun, when he started, how this all this stuff started?
Yeah, that's what's scary with what's going on in today's climate as well, David. The fact that it is relatively easy to do.
It is, and well, yeah, unfortunately,
yeah.
Because it's not that hard to build a nuclear weapon. You know, I can sit here and show you how it's done.
No, don't.
Yeah, really, but that's a problem. And I find it very frustrating sometimes living on this planet, because the knowledge, the pursuit of knowledge is absolutely in prison with its insane desire to make it into something hostile. And it's such a waste of activity and creativity, because that's what happened. Eventually, I was going to have a head-on collision with the military in this, and that did indeed happen.
At what age, then, did these major corporations really start to get an interest in you?
Well, when I was sweeping everything and winning stuff left and right, it really wasn't the corporations the problem. What happened, it was the government.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because what happened was, it takes so long to explain this stuff. We missed a factor here. I need to know a lot of things about what's happening with the rocket just as it breaks the event horizon. If I could see frame by frame on a video, we didn't have video.
No, cameras. We didn't. It just had film in those days.
But if I could get a really fast camera, I could see frame by frame the exhaust plume, and that would tell me by the color differentials where things are happening.
Right.
It would be a big help. So we had no cameras like that. There was no computer. There was no VCRs, no camcorders, no faxes, no cell phones. Yeah, we didn't even have a handheld calculator. That come 11 years later from Texas Instruments. All we had was a thing called a slide ruler, and we had paper and lots of big chalkboards.
And the Chinese abacus, if you needed to use that abacus.
So I called the local press, big mistake, and I asked them, do you guys have cameras that can film it faster than 1,000 frames a second? And they're going, yeah, we got a special one here that can do that. And they said,
what do you need it for?
They said, yeah, what are you photographing? I went, well, I have these rockets coming out, and then there was this, you're the one.
Yep.
And they said, we've heard thunder in the distance. The nearest town was 20 miles away, but they could hear them.
They could hear that?
Oh, God, yes.
You mean, did you have police officers coming by trying to check out what's going on?
As long as it wasn't bothering anybody or anything. I mean, these are Midwest farmers, you know, private, you know, patriots, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, back then nobody was worried. It's always odd hearing thunder on a clear blue day with no clouds. But some people got used to it, and it didn't bother any chickens or laying eggs or anything. They didn't care. So, but the news people were going, you're the one. So I said, well, could you come out? And they said, well, we want to do a story on you. I'll tell you what, you can do a story if you bring your cameras.
Yep, you wanted a little trade out here.
Yeah, so I'm bartering already. I'm learning quick. And I went, story equals cameras. If you bring the cameras, I get film footage, you can get a story. And they're going, are you kidding? We wouldn't dare come out without cameras. So I have this big, thick, 4-inch-thick book lane here of all these newspaper stories on me. And that was the beginning of it. And they came out there, and my dad and I brought one of the rockets out, and it was a fairly big one. And so I thought, well, I want to test one of the fastest things I got. So I brought one of the biggest rockets I had out. So we're standing there, and we get ready to launch. I tell the guy, the editor, it was the editor of the paper, and his photographer, Virgil, and Hal Clausen. And Hal and Virgil were standing there, and I said, well, okay, guys, this thing's going to come out of the pit, so make sure you photograph it. Oh, yeah, we can do that, Sonny, no problem. So my dad is sitting on the tailgate of his 55 DeSoto station wagon, and he's watching this. He's lighting his pipe, and he... And so I'm over there at the control board, and this thing comes out of there. And when these things come out of that pit, they come out with such a fury that there's a vortex behind them. It's sucking up little trees, twigs, limbs.
My guest, David Adair, his website, flyingsaucers.com, all linked up with coasttocoastam.com. Why the verbiage flyingsaucers.com, David?
It's a coffee company. It's a coffee thing. The logo is a coffee cup on a saucer plate with a putt-putt trail behind it going through space. And a business partner, friend of mine, Rick Austin, has that thing. And he asked me if he could set my name up on his website for exposure. I said, sure, Rick. And so what happened was, after I did that marathon session with Art Bell, that website, in 24 hours after Art Bell, got 14,000 hits.
Yep.
And emails in the thousands. It took me forever to read every one of the emails. And that's something I'd like to make a point on is the only reason I'm doing this show tonight with you, your producer called me at Flying Saucers. Then she called me at where I was at several times and asked me to do the show. Then finally I agreed because there's apparently a lot of people out there want to know whatever happened to me. And And I seem to have groupies or fans out there.
You
and,
do, yeah.
And they really, they were very kind. These people are really, really sweet little emails they wrote me. And I feel I kind of owe those people something.
Good for you.
So I thought I better come on the air and talk to you guys while I'm back here in America, because I no longer live in America.
You do not, do
nope.
you?
No,
you,
I don't.
Do you disclose where you live?
No, I don't. I'll give you a vague idea.
All right.
I'm on the west end of the Caribbean on an island, and the country that's in charge of that island has agreed, in exchange for me teaching their math and science teachers in big workshops, bringing them up to speed with the 21st century, I can have at where we're at the Tropic of Cancer, I can reach equatorial orbit. So I am now launching rockets at a suborbital flight, but I'm about to go orbital.
Why don't you take advantage of the XPRIZE?
I'm just not interested in that because I've got an entirely different agenda. People can fly into space and do the return thing. That's good. But I have got to finish this this engine, which I was interrupted on building the first time.
And we'll get into that. And is there a reason why you're not here?
I really love America, and I love the people, even though we're all so damn dysfunctional. We're still a really pretty cool group of people to hang with on the planet. It's the government I got problems with. I've had continuous problems, and it's just like not getting any better. So outside this bubble you live in called America, controlled by the media, there's an entire world out there, y'all, and they're not all that far behind. In some areas, they're more advanced than the science in America. And I'm helping to contribute to that, and
well, it's
a lot more freedom out there.
It's a shame we're losing your mind power, David.
Well, you haven't lost my heart, because I'm still always being American, and right. I'm actually trying to do this for all of you.
All right, well, we'll talk a little bit about this engine in a second. Well, let's pick up then, if we can, and a lot of people still want to get you to talk about Area 51. They're biting at the bit on that.
I know, poor thing.
Let's get, so you've got some of the media, they're there with their cameras,
yeah.
the rocket's starting. It's got this vortex.
That's right, and it comes ripping out of there. And, I mean, it creates a vacuum. Sometimes it can pull the air right out of your lungs. You can just feel it. It's just such a force. And so I'm looking up at the rocket, and I said, "You guys get that?" And I don't hear anything. And my dad says in a real calm voice with his pipe, goes, "Dave, I don't think those boys got it." And I turn around and look at them. And their cameras are dangling down by their sides on the end of the straps, and their mouths are hanging open and looking straight up, and their hair is disruffled from the vacuum. And
they're in shock.
Yeah, basically, yeah. I walked over and I go, "What are you guys doing?" And they they finally got closed their mouths. And they went, "My God, boy, you know, I'm not expecting this." So fortunately, I had another rocket, and that one came back down right where I wanted it. So I said, "Wait, we got another one in the pit." So I just had a feeling this might happen, so I was already pre-planned for it. So I said, "Can you guys film this one?" And they, yeah. So they got some great photo footage, which did help me out. But, man, the minute these guys filed a story, back then they had wire service called API and UPI.
This was almost worldwide, wasn't it?
Yeah, and they snapped these stories up, and my God, what happened after that became a zoo and a circus, because everybody and their brother were coming at me, and I'm just trying to stay, you know, I was more of an introvert back then, I was very busy.
Oh, and you're what, 13 years old?
Yeah, and so what happened was I get a call from my local congressman. And here's where it starts.
Uh-huh.
And I'm invited to a political picnic. And I thought, well, I should go because he had helped, or at least his office did once before, in some scholarship funding. So anyway, I get to the picnic, and this congressman, a very famous congressman, John Ashbrook of Ohio, he runs over and throws his arm around me, and the photos go off.
Oh, of course.
Look what I've done for this child. And I'm standing there looking to go, what?
Probably didn't even know your name at the time, right?
Oh, man, I'm going, what is this man talking about? And so anyway, after a couple of picnics, I noticed, I started thinking about it, and I looked at newspaper stories and followed up on his polls were slagging a little bit, and all of a sudden they increased dramatically.
Oh, yeah.
And because I'm a newspaper story, it's all every other week now. So he took me to another political picnic and a party, and I was there. And when he came over to me, I handed him this paper, which was stapled together, and it's about 20 pages, and he's going through it, and he goes, "What's this?" And I go, "There's a list of materials and access to places and people I'm going to need to get this next thing done." And he's going through it, "Oak Ridge, Tennessee, particle accelerators, Lawrence Livermore Laboratory." He's going, "What in God's name are you building?" I said, "Well, it's a form of a fusion, electromagnetic fusion containment engine." And he goes, "I can't do this. It's absurd." So he handed me a paperback, and I said, "Well, I'll tell you what. See that press over there? I'm going to go over there and tell them that you've been dragging me around like a monkey on a chain here."
Yes, 13 years old, and you're saying this.
Absolutely, because I am pissed at this moment. And John may be 13, but I understand adult innuendos.
Pretty grown-up 13-year-old.
Well, that's what happens, I guess, when you read too much. But anyway, I said, "I'm going to go over there and tell the press, and you won't even get elected as a dog catcher." So he goes, "You're kidding." So I said, "Watch." And I'm walking to the press people, and they, "Hi." And they go, "David." And he goes, "Wait a minute." And he goes, "Let me see that list." And then he goes, "This is blackmail." I said, "Yeah, I learned it from you people." So anyway, I said, "You got 3 days. And if I don't have 3 days, I'm talking to the press." Well, he wasn't a happy camper.
My God, you were demanding, huh?
Well, it's for his own good and everybody else's. Like I said, I was hard back then,
right.
I guess. But driven, and
you were obsessed with this project.
I told you it's a form of a disease, actually, and so I was just, you know, I was just driven if we're going to do this. And so anyhow, the Congress was trying to work on it. My mom sees all this going on, and she gets concerned about dealing, you know, strong arm in a congressman. So she thought she better go get somebody to help out. Well, since my dad was injured, if you remember, she went back to work, and she became an LPN, a practical nurse. Now, she had two elderly patients that she was a caregiver to, and the old man knocked her out one time with a cane. They were in their 90s, and she could handle the guy. But they were a feisty couple, and they both were up in their 90s. And they had a retired son, you know, that was living in California at the time that would come and see parents regularly. And my mother and him were very, very close. Well, these people's name was LeMay, and their son's name was Curtis.
The
Curtis LeMay, four-star general, former, and the head of SAC, joint chief of staff, the whole thing. So my mother started showing him the newspaper stories, and he had been following me for a couple years, for about a year and a half, and then she told him what happened with the congressman. And he told me his reply was, "Congressmen, they're like diapers. They're full of crap, and you got to change them often." So he could smoke a stogie like you wouldn't believe. And so he told my mom he would help. And so he started looking at all the stuff I was doing. She let him in the lab when I wasn't there, and he looked at everything. That was enough for him. And so he called a congressman. He told the congressman that he's going to become project manager on this.
He's going to get this done.
Right. And all of a sudden, we go from an operation in a cow field to a congressman getting funding through the National Science Foundation to the Air Force general, who pushes it into a black op operation.
This is incredible.
And I'm sitting there going, "You've got to be kidding." I am just like, whatever. And I knew that it was going to take this kind of activity. I just was concerned if I could survive the ride through it all.
Oh, exactly. And the politics and everything else that was going to go along with it.
I totally had an absolute grasp of all that, even at that age.
Now, were you still in high school, I guess, junior high school? Yeah,
junior high. And meanwhile, while the junior high people, like my peer members, are learning to drink Boone Farm and going to parties and going to drive-ins and learning about anatomy in the back seat, I am working quantum physics, differential mechanics, assembling particle accelerators, and trying to figure out what would be the next step, assembling an entire work crews together. And on a Gantt chart, I could see that it was going to take just thousands of man-hours to get this thing done. And so I had to plot everything on a Gantt chart, because I knew this is going to have to be farmed out in different layers and different positions, different groups. And it's got, and knowing the military, they're going to want to modularize everything so nobody can figure out exactly what's going on and when the whole thing's put together.
Now, were they simultaneously, David, working on a fusion engine on their own projects before you even came to the scene?
Well, what happened was, it takes so long to do the story.
Yeah, and if we don't get to Area 51, we're both going to get lynched here.
I know. Well, see, what happened was, I knew Von Braun, okay, and I knew Von Braun because of all the awards I won, right? Okay, and I met him when I was 12, and because I was winning awards, and we, as we got further along, and by the time I was 15, it's 1969, there was Neil Armstrong on the moon. I'm in Ohio. Wapakoneta is just about a two-hour drive from there, from where I was, and when you have a celebrity will show up at the award ceremony to hang a medal around your neck, that is how I became such close friends with Viola Armstrong, Neil's mother.
Aha, okay.
So when Neil was walking on the moon, I was sitting between Viola Armstrong's knees at her house.
Oh, my.
And when Neil was on sleeping on the moon, I was sleeping in Neil's bed.
What a story.
So that's, and it's just a long process. It all keeps building up. And anyhow, you should see all the gifts and cards and photos I got here of, with Viola and myself.
Oh, you must have just a trophy of so many things.
Well, I'm sitting in the library right now, and it's completely filled from one end to the other.
But good for you, though.
But actually, I do it just to try to save credibility. But anyhow, the cast of characters just keeps building, and it's also
so more power players are coming to the scene then
as this
evolves, right?
You wouldn't believe. Well, see, now I'm dealing with the AEC, the Atomic Energy Commission, because what has happened? What, go back to your original question where they were working on something like it. What happened was Von Braun had me stop when I was coming back from a launch to watching a launch I was a guest of. I stopped at Marshall Space Flight Center in Huntsville, Alabama, and that's their long-range planning division.
Mm-hmm.
And I was flipping through this book that had, at that time, about 77 different type of rocket engines. The only type two that we're used to is solid fuel and liquid propellant. But there is just multitudes of other kinds. And so anyway, I was flipping through their stuff, and I came across this thing that said EMFC, and that's an electromagnetic fusion containment. And that goes back to it was coming out of work on the fusion reactors, where they're trying to do a containment cell for the fusion reactors. And I was sitting there going, wow, if we could build a scaled-down version of this and do a flash pulse out of a fusion reaction through an EFMC process, we could have a magnetic bottle, and inside you would have the power of the sun available to tap, and if you use the right particle beam formations with the lasers for the guidance of the opening of the orifice, then you could have expulsion out the rear of one specific impulse point, which is the heart of a rocket engine, and you got thrust.
And it would also be fuelless, wouldn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Nope. It would have its own fuel. I was just looking just enough for a flash test. Because the multiple, this is just the first rung on a several steps of a ladder that would get you to where you could reach an EFMC status, which where you would have a total containment field. But I was just trying to get to a flash pulse, and if I could hold it long enough there, then I could see, could learn enough. It wants to sit back to the math.
They must have been astonished by your brain power.
Well,
they must have been.
Well, they were kind of, they were a little bit...
mystified?
Yeah, perplexed. And actually, a lot of them were very, very, very nice. They were just very helpful.
I mean, did they learn from you, or did you learn from them?
It was a symbiotic relationship.
Okay.
Definitely on the practical side, they were very helpful. It seems like on the theoretical side, I had somewhat of a better insight on some things, and it might be because, well, see, you have to understand something happened with me right then at that time. And later on, Duke University, with their research and stuff, we figured out what happened to me. It's from age 12 to age 17, I had, like, I was like a savant. I should say more like, you know, I was, it allowed me, oh my God, the things I could do, and the way I could remember things. I could remember entire volumes of books at a time, and that was, but it consumed my life till I was, you know, just totally not socially functional, but I could work at that. And mm-hmm. it, and later, as years went on and I finished all this, it started tapering off, and that was one of the most frightening events of my life, because I know how an Alzheimer's patient feels, because what happens, you start, memory goes, and you can't remember how to do things,
right,
and I'd look
right.
at all of this math in my own handwriting, remember writing it, and I can't work it, and then eventually it just keeps fading away, and I'm afraid I'm going to reduce down to a vegetable. But,
or at least down to our level.
Yeah, well, anyway, I got down to where I am now, and if you think I'm smart now, my God, you should have seen me then. And so this is just fragments or shadows of what it used to be like. And I'm not the only one that's had this happen. It's they have a long name, about a foot long medical condition that it spikes in your early childhood like that. Mozart probably suffered from it.
He might have been. Okay, now get yourself over to Area 51.
All right, so what happens? There's so many other characters and people get involved. I'm just trying to cut through this. You know, it's so much for credibility. We get the thing built. There are hundreds of people involved. There are all kinds of other interacting agencies. There is... you know, Oak Ridge and AEC and Lawrence Livermore, and I go down the list. And anyway, we get this thing done, and we put it on a transport at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base.
Mm-hmm.
We fly to White Sands, New Mexico, because we all agreed that's about the only place to be able to test this thing. And that's when we get down there. We get everything in place. It's all set up. We're ready to go. And then... that's where another character shows up, and he's probably the antagonist in the story.
And who is he?
He is named Dr. Arthur Rudolph. Dr. Arthur Rudolph was the chief engineer of the Apollo Saturn F1 engines. He is the guy that built the Apollo rocket engines.
This is Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie. David Adair, my guest. David, so the antagonist enters the picture, and you're in New Mexico at this point?
Yeah, we're at White Sands, and we got everything unloaded, and we were there for about a day. And I had a meeting or a talk with Von Braun before I left from there. And he had warned me at the rate I was going and things were accelerating. He was aware of what was going on with all the stuff I was in. And he had told me if I ever... there was a meeting where I was at the Cape at one of his offices, and there was a picture of him from coming over from West Germany, or from Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And there were a group of the scientists that came in with him in that group through Operation Paperclip. And I pointed to a guy and asked him who was that he was standing with. And he goes, "That's Arthur Rudolph." And he said, "If you ever run into him, you're going to have a really hard time." He goes, "Unlike the rest of us, he also was a colonel in the Gestapo Army." He also was responsible for 30,000 deaths of French, Polish, Russian, Czech, and Italian laborers who perished in 2 years. You killed 30,000 people in 2 years in a subterranean madhouse called by the Nazis' own chief medical officer, Dante's Inferno. They forced the inmates to build the V-2 rockets there at Metalworks, and they fed the inmates sawdust bread and spittle soup and worked them for 12-hour shifts at a time until they'd fall over. If you made a mistake on the line, they would hang you up and Rudolph would disembowel you, and they'd leave you hang there till the smell was so bad that the guards had to get rid of it.
Oh, my God.
And so that is your winner of the Distinguished Service Medal, the highest award NASA can give. And on May 25th, 1984, he was deported out of San Francisco with a one-way ticket back to Munich, Germany. where he was left to stay because of the war crimes. But they didn't prosecute him.
Is he still alive?
No, he's died.
He has passed on.
So, anyway, that's... So he shows up. Sure enough, we're there. This black jet lands. It's a DC-9. I asked, where's the white bunny head on the tail? And it comes back.
Yeah, really? You were too young for that. You didn't know what that
was. I was aware of it. And I thought it was a funny joke, but I looked around and nobody's smiling. And the colonel that was assigned to me by LeMay and the sergeant and the lieutenant, they looked pretty grim. And so I figured, boy, this must be... it must be something from DOD. And so these guys get out, sure enough, black suits, mirror sunglasses, and except this one little guy in a khaki suit gets out and shorts. And but I recognize this picture, his face from the picture in Von Braun's office, and it's Rudolph. And he comes over, and he comes straight into the hangar where we had the rocket, and he wanted to look at it, and we had to go into a special room because of the isotopes that the fuels, charged pellets that's involved. So anyway, he's wants to see the engine. So he looks down in the engine, and I hear him mumbling. I had asked him before he bent down to look into the engine, you know, what, you know, who are you? And he goes, I'm just a guy that looks at rockets for the military.
Yeah, and he had no no input into the building of this, right?
No, not at this point.
Okay.
But I think they were just curious to see how this thing would come together.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, they were aware of it. They, because of the timing, they were ready for the demonstration. And so anyway, as he's bending over and looking in the rocket, I'm on the opposite side of it, and facing the cross from him. So I bend over and put my mouth right by his ear, and I just go, do you know that this engine has 10,000 times the power of the F-1 Saturn V engines, Dr. Rudolph? Man, he springs up, and he's as red as a tomato, and he's, I don't know what he's saying, but he's going at me in German, so I figured it wasn't too good.
Which, by the way, he helped develop with Von Braun, right?
That's right.
Okay.
So, anyway, he's obviously upset, and now the colonel's there, and they get into, it's a big argument, and there's all kinds of things going on. And anyhow, lots of intrigue, stuff goes on. God, there's so much detail. The thing is, Rudolph...
And so much detail and not enough time.
No, Rudolph wants me to change the coordinates. We could bring this thing, we could launch this thing and get it right back in White Sands. No, he wants it dropped 456 miles, and I can't remember the exact coordinates, but it's exactly where he wants it. So I go over to the shack house, I pull out the geographic survey maps, and I look it up and plot it out, and I'm going, it's a place called Groom Lake, Nevada. What the? It's a dry lake bed. And I come back to him, why in God's name you want this thing in a dry lake bed? And have you looked at that jet out there? It's got rubber tires. You guys will moor up to your belly if you try to land there. You know, and he is quite hostile now. And he tells me change the coordinates there.
He's so, telling you, 14-year-old kid probably by this time, right?
Yeah, and he said change the coordinates. Or have somebody else do it. And I said, I'll do it. Well, I can do it better than anybody else because I built a thing. And so I'm changing everything. And now I notice that the colonel and Williams and Sergeant Lowkey are really looking upset. And the rocket rips out of there. Holy smokes. It leaves so fast you can't even see it. And... and it goes exactly where they want it. And as soon as it breaks the apogee and it's coming back in, the thermals leads on it picks up the sensors as we come in on our tracking, so everything's automatic for the
right.
for steering in. It's coming right in, right on target. And by that time, the red phone rings, and it's they pick up the phone, and it's NORAD, and they are really pissed off.
They have no idea what's going on.
No.
Nobody's told them.
Nobody told them anything, and they want to know what in God's name is moving that fast. Because it was, and we were pushing over 8,000 miles an hour. There's nothing moving that fast, anything, in just seconds like that. So we told them it was a civilian kid's, or a civilian's rocket down here on testing. Well, that's some kind of rocket. Well, what the hell is somebody telling us something? Because, you know, we're ready to move up in DEFCON here if you keep this crap.
Yeah,
this guy's upset. So anyway, that's when I started realizing, man, I don't think any of this is planned, and this is just being conducted by a very small group because the bigger bulk of the systems don't know what's going on.
Don't know what's happening, exactly.
So I'm starting to put it together. I'm going, well, this is not good. So we turned around, and now Rudolph tells me to get on the plane.
And I'm going, on the black jet that showed up?
Yeah, the black jet. And I said, I don't think so. You know, he said, yeah, get on the plane. So the his guys in black suits, man, we're all huddled. We're going. Now I know Sergeant Loki comes over to my defense, and now it's getting real intense because Loki's got a sidearm. And I can see it's really not getting, it's really intense.
They're not going to shoot you.
No, I think Loki would shoot the guys in black because they are taking me. And LeMay specifically said I wasn't to leave the base. So now what happens, we're put on a black jet. I go off with the guys in the suit. Colonel Williams and Sergeant Loki, everybody else is left behind.
Off you go.
Off we go. And I'm going, oh, my God.
You have no idea where you're going.
No, and on top of that, now I'm with these people. Nobody back in Wright-Patterson even knows where I'm at or where I'm going. The people that was with me are now left behind at White Sands, and now I'm cut off from everybody.
Did you ever get to a point where you said, I just want to go home?
Yeah, I did. I was sitting in the seat, and actually, I was, well, at that point, you know, I didn't do, I just wanted not anything, but just one thing, get me to my rocket. I want to look at it. That's all I wanted to see.
Okay.
I really didn't care. And
and did it land in the right spot?
Oh, yeah. We fly over, and we circle, and I look down and go, holy God, there's these huge runways down there, and, you know, buildings, complex. It's a big base. I'm going, it's not on the map, is it?
No,
it's not on the government geological survey maps, you know, just dry lake bed. So we land, and we taxi to the center hangar, and we stop, and we get out. And I couldn't help but notice things. It's just this whole place is odd.
Describe it to me.
Well, the first thing I notice, I get up, I look at the top of the buildings, and they all have these big lights, and these lights have louvers. And I thought, well, I'm looking at the louvers, and I look out over the plain, over the desert, and I'm going, wow. These louvers are designed to shine light down on the ground, and from a distance, you can't see the lights. Now, why would they bother to louver the lights like that? And I'm going, huh. So then we get closer to the building. I'm going, well, that's odd. These buildings are painted where they look old. But when you get close to it, the fixtures and joints, everything is shiny and brand new. And I'm going, well, it's painted like it's been here for a while, but it's a really strange-looking alloy. And then we get on these things that I really don't know what to do. They look like a cart from the airport where at least, you know, six or seven people can ride in.
Yeah.
But these things, they're built really odd, man. They have a thing in the center front grill that lights up as whatever the power plant is. And these things, they make a whine. And I don't know what they are because it doesn't sound or run like an electric car.
Does it fly or just touch the ground?
No, it's just rolling wheels. But man, they're fast and they're smooth and they're silent except for a small whine and no exhaust pipes, nothing. I'm going, man, what kind of power plant's in this?
And you're looking at it and...
Yeah, and well, they grab me and throw me on the back seat where I'm facing out the back.
Yeah.
And I'm looking backwards as we ride forward. So I'm sitting there and there's guards with us and everything and we drive into the center of the hangar, which is empty, and it stops and then we're sitting there. I'm going, okay, this is good. Why are we sitting here? Then these lights come on at all the doorways. These guardrails come up out of the ground and block off all the doors and entranceways. And then this floor, about the size of a football field, just drops out from under us. It's an elevator. It's a huge elevator. So the first thing I'm thinking of, look at the size of this concrete mass floor. It's got to be in the tens of tons.
And it's moving.
I'm going, man, what is controlling the load on this thing? What cable system? So as we get down, and then I see them turning. You ever seen a worm screw? It's the same kind of screw that makes your garage go. These things are the size of sequoia tree trunks, and there's like 12 of them. And they're lowering this floor up and down. This thing designed to carry something massive, heavy, up and down. And so I'm going, well, whatever it is, they certainly are going to use some big things.
Well, and as you're going down, what are the inside walls look like? Just
the
flat?
They look like some kind of a sprayed concrete.
Okay.
But it's not quite like concrete. It's almost like a matte, like a gray matte felt. It's just odd. And the rock that it was covering, the rock itself was real shiny, glazed. And the only thing I could think of was, my God, what kind of heat did these rocks see? They're almost crystallized, almost like a glazed ham. And we get on down to the, we go down about 200 feet, and we flush out at the bottom, and boy, there's a, it's like, it looks like the Mammoth Cave, if you've ever seen that thing, the Grand Ballroom.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It goes so far, you can't see the end of it.
And it's all lit up?
Well, that's a hell of a good question, because it's totally lit. I'm moving my arms, and I notice there's no shadows. And I'm looking around, I see no light fixtures anywhere. And I'm going, how is this place lit?
Yeah.
And it's kind of a rainbow cavern covering. It's all finished off inside. The walls canter down till they flatten vertically perpendicular, so you can have workshops, offices, and big work base.
And are they talking to you at all, David? Or are they telling you where you're going or why?
No, they're not saying squat to me. And it's Rudolph, some of the black suit guys. There's a colonel there that's obviously a colonel of the base, and some other people and guards. And I'm sitting by myself facing out the back. And they're pretty much quiet. And so, you know, they're really not saying anything. And I'm looking around. And just strange stuff just keeps going on. It's we ride down past things, and I noticed some hallways were strange. The people were coming in and out of them, and it looked like a gas was in the corridor. You could see people walk in and out of the gas, and they'd have these glasses that they put on and put off. And I first thought, well, that hallway's full of smoke. I mean,
no masks or respirators or anything like that?
No, just glasses. And I'm going, damn, that's odd. You know, it must be some kind of, you know, clean room or cooling duct or something or whatever it is they're doing. And then we move on down more, and as we get closer to this one big work bay, I notice the doors are closing. And
behind you?
No, on the side.
Okay.
The big work bay that we're coming up to, but they're closing the doors, and they're going to be almost closed before we get there. So I thought, maybe they don't want me looking there. So I try leaning around, and just at the last moment, I kind of lean forward and get a glimpse in there. And, man, there was the strangest looking craft I've ever seen. It looked like a giant teardrop. And there were scaffolds all over it and people working, but it was big. I mean, this thing was really big. And also sitting down there was the XB-70. Do you remember that thing?
Oh, yeah.
It was sitting down there. And, I mean, this place was huge. You could have ran dozens of 747s around without bumping into anything.
And how do you think they raised them to the surface? The same way came down?
I would assume the same way. That's the only port that I saw. But there might have been ports on down further. But we only went down a ways, I would say, probably about a half mile when we stopped.
So the doors to this teardrop object finally closed?
Yeah, and I noticed Rudolph was looking at me. I looked at him, he looked back at me, and there was this really weird thing. I didn't like the man, but there was, at the same time, there was some kind of mutual respect or something.
There was a synergy there,
well,
wasn't there?
It was this intellect that kind of connected, I guess. He appreciated, understood what was happening, or was picking up quickly, or catching up. And
at least brain power, maybe he saw himself in you.
Possible, but I tell you what, I wouldn't think I had.
Not that I'm calling you one of him.
Right.
No.
But we did get along a little bit, because when the military people would talk to us, it actually irritated him when they talked to me the way they talked to me. They were condescending. They treated me like I was what I was at the time. I was a teenager.
Right.
And so anyway, that really became annoying when we got to where we were going, and we got to this big door. This guy jumps out, runs over, puts his face in this funnel-looking thing. There's a flash on his face, and his palms are on a glass sheet.
Mm-hmm.
And the door opens up, and I'm sitting there going, now what was that? Did I just see some kind of optical scanner pump? This is 1971, man.
Yeah.
There is nothing like any of this stuff. And this place has already got technology going that I have never seen.
Way ahead,
anywhere.
That's right.
And I'm more interested in just the facilities. Like, somebody tell me how the lights work. And so the doors open up, and we go in, and sure enough, it's dark. Lights come up, like on a rheostat. but yet there's no light fixtures. And I'm going, man, if I could just figure out the light switches here, I'd be happy.
It's just, it's bright in there, but you don't see anything.
That's, well,
you don't see the fixtures.
You don't see the fixtures, and it's a very comfortable lighting. It's lit perfectly right for the retina.
Yeah.
And yet there's no shadows. I would move my arms everywhere. I'm going, how is this done without shadows? This is just... we pull in, and there's something sitting on a very large steel platform with some scaffolding around it, but you can't see it because there's a big drape hanging around it that has cables from the ceiling, and so this drape can be pulled up and down. And I'm sitting there going, wow, wonder what this is. So they tell me get out and stand there, and I do, and Rudolph motions for him to raise up the curtain. So the curtain goes up, and holy smokes, man, I about had a heart attack. Now, my engine, when I built it, because of the cyclotrons and the way it's configured, the easiest way to describe what it looks like, imagine two octopuses having sex. Okay, that's
a hodgepodge.
Well, two round spheres facing each other,
yeah,
with very
intricate, with tentacles in between.
Right, with intricate plumbing in between them. That's for the plasma ducts to travel with and containment field. If you could see inside the engine, it's set up where I have two spheres mating together. And if they do that, what does that make? A figure eight.
So, David, then you are witnessing this engine that looks like an eight.
Right. If you can see inside the engines how they're these type of engines are set up, what's a number eight turned sideways in math?
Infinity.
Right.
Yeah.
They're laid out for that reason, because with the flow of the plasma and the chain reaction and with the particles and everything, if you could get it in a continuous run where it's chasing its own self, it's a self-containment system. And we just don't have a time, but I would love to go into how this thing actually works. But what happens next is my engine is about the size of a big watermelon, okay? And they raise the curtain up on this thing, and I am staring at an EFMC engine sitting on this big, massive stand. But this thing's the size of a Greyhound bus.
Okay, your engine pushed that rocket that went into Groom Lake. How big was that rocket?
That rocket stood about 12 feet tall, and we were about 2 feet in diameter. And my engine that drove that thing wasn't much bigger than a very large watermelon.
Right. Now, this engine would push something how big?
Oh, my God. If you go on scale comparison, I don't know what math they use, but anywhere in proportional, a gas would have to be at least 300 feet or more. Way over a football field.
Just huge, huge.
Right, or even bigger. My God, with the power that this engine has, it could power a craft, a mile in length. I don't know. It's just it's hard to make a determination because. It didn't take me more than maybe 30, 40 seconds after concentrating from first being shocked. I thought I had a kind of an exclusive on this and find out, man, somebody's, I have a Volkswagen and this thing is a Viper.
Now, were you able to figure out if this engine came from that craft that you saw down there or whether it was constructed by us?
No, I couldn't. Well, I wouldn't think it come from the craft that I saw because... Even though it was big, this engine would be way too big for it.
Okay.
Way too big. But it's how this engine is built and the way it looks is where the problem starts with if it's built by us. It's just no way this engine could be built by us. This engine is an exoskeleton structure. The best way to describe it, there's this artist, which is a strange artist named H.R. Giger. And Geiger is the guy that designed all the alien architecture and look in the movie Aliens with Sigourney Weaver.
Okay, sure, sure.
They call that organic technology, where, like, vertebrates are turns into frames of the craft.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And what looks like blood vessels are actually hydraulic lines and all that such. But it's an eerie look. And I swear, I met Geiger once, and after this incident, I think he's just visiting. That is a strange man. Lord have mercy. But anyhow, this thing is an exoskeleton structural system. But, man, it's the the first thing that you notice, as big as it is, in my engine, I have about several miles of wiring. This thing doesn't have wiring. My wiring is in a conventional shape of like a soccer ball. Did you know if you had a soccer ball in 1944, you would have been arrested forever? Because that's what the original atomic bomb looked like.
Yeah, you're right. As a matter of fact, that's what the universe looks like.
Precisely. Yeah. So, this thing had looked like wiring, but looked more like fiber...
optics?
Well, yeah, it's like fiber optics, but there was some kind of fluid in them, and it caused it with that. It's iridescent in color. And
almost like an umbilical cord?
Well, yeah, but it would. There were hundreds of thousands, and they cascaded over its surface. But the pattern that they cascaded in looked just like a neural firing circuit of a brain.
Does it look biological to you?
Oh, absolutely. And the other thing, as big as it was, not one bolt, one rivet, one nut, one weld line, one seam line, nothing. It looked like it grew like a plant or an animal.
Now, were there guys running around this thing?
No. It's just sitting on a stage all by itself, up on a platform by itself. There's nobody around it. They raised the curtain.
Was it moving, pulsating, anything like that?
No. There really wasn't. There was really no sounds, no noise. But in the main bay, it was warm. But when we got in this room, it was very cool. Just a little bit warmer than you could see your breath. So it's very cool in there. And so I asked if I could get up on a stage and take a closer look. And that's when the problem started.
Okay.
Because what happened, the colonel says to me, well, son, that's what we want. We want you to help us. You want to help your government, and your don't you, son? And I'm looking at him. I'm going, you got to be kidding. So I just went, yes, sir, I listened to Anita Bryant. And this is 1971, and I'm now 17.
I'm 21 at that time.
Okay, and yeah. So you know how they talk to us.
Yep, yep.
So I'm sitting there going, and Rudolph is looking irritated with all this. And because he knows I'm just not buying it. And he said, our people have been working on this engine, and you got an engine kind of similar like ours. And he goes, as you can see, there's a damaged place in it. And there was. There's a huge hole gaped in the side where this, it looked like there was a failure at the eye of the hurricane point, that where the two figure eights would cross each other in the center of an eight. That's where it had a detonation. It looked like the containment field gave loose. Our engines run at 50 million degrees centigrade. And suddenly this wall of this material, whatever it is, was exposed to that heat and started vaporizing. But because it hit there, it probably shut down in a picosecond, in a trillionth of a second. So it didn't obliterate the engine. It just shut down.
And, you know, if they were asking you for help, I would think, if you built this, what do you need me here for?
Well, let's get into that.
Yeah.
They asked me, why, so where's the people who works on this thing? Well, they're on vacation. You're on vacation.
Oh, yeah,
I
right.
Said, well, aren't you, son? I went, oh, okay. I said, well, did they leave any notes? And he goes, well, they got homework. You have homework. They had to take it with them. And I'm going, oh, brother. So, anyway, Rudolph is now steps forward. He's going to say something. And I just said, can I look at the engine? They said, yeah. So I get up on the platform, and I take a closer steps to it. I get about maybe 3 feet from it. And then the first thing I notice is, there's my silhouette on the side of it. Now, what have I been telling you through this whole thing?
No shadows.
And I'm going, wow. And I'm looking around and up and down, and I don't see any light fixtures. So I wave my arms, and guess what? The shadow is about a half second behind me before it catches up. And I'm going, so I start walking down, and it catches up, and I'm going, is this alloyed heat-sensitive recognition alloy? Is this thing picking up some kind of thermal radiation off of me? This is incredible. I said, we don't have any alloys like that. And the color of this thing, only some people our age would remember this. Remember methylate?
Yeah.
And mercurochrome?
Yes.
And you ever seen it in the sunlight, that look? And for people who don't know what we're talking about, have you ever seen a tailpipe of a motorcycle as chrome and it's burnt on the end and they get that rainbow-looking color?
Mm-hmm.
That it's iridescent. This whole thing was like an iridescent rainbow-colored device. And I'm sitting there going, wow, that is, it's just not painted. It's actually the color of the material. And that's another thing. It's, I don't know how that could even be done like that.
Was it solid or was it kind of spongy?
Oh no, it was hard as diamond.
It was, okay.
And, but this is where it really gets weird. If it ain't strange enough already, I turn around to the Rudolph and I go, could I please crawl up on top of this thing and look in the damage area? I just had to know. Because when I built my engine, I know how my area is so small, we'd have to sometimes use microscopic processing just to get things built. This thing's so big, you could crawl in it. And I'm sitting there going, I've just got to look inside. So Rudolph, the colonel didn't want it. Rudolph said, yeah, go ahead. So I turn, and there's these vent-type things, which look like it'll be perfect to crawl up on. And I don't know what half the stuff is on this engine does, because, quite frankly, it looks alien. And so as soon as I touch the engine, the first thing I notice, it's warm. And I'm going, how could this much metal be warm and it's this cold in the room? And I'm looking around, I see no power cables, so how is this thing generating?
Yeah, and it's not fired up.
No, and I'm sitting there going, my God, it's as warm as my own body temperature. I'm going, gee whiz. But it's, if that didn't catch your attention, it's wherever your skin is touching it, you get this terrific-looking cascade waveforms that cascade down its body coming off your hand. And it kind of looks like, you know, the sand that you have and the wave thing that you play with on a desk?
Sure.
It would wave like that. And it was a kind of a blue-white, real nice-looking swirl. And I let go, and it would dissipate, and I put it back on. It comes on. I'm going, wow, this is too cool. So we crawl up on this thing. I notice where my feet are. There's no waves because I have shoes on. So it's got to be a flesh contact. And I'm going, man, how does this thing do this, and why is it doing it?
Your brain must have been going a mile
on that. It was all I could do, just to breathe. And so I get up on top of this thing. I'm walking down it, and the outside part runs. It's got like a dorsal fin look to it, and it's like vertebrates. And I'm stepping over them, but this thing's big. So I get to the damage area, and I look down inside, and, oh, man, there is just some fabulous-looking stuff.
Now, let me ask you for a moment, David. This wasn't a craft by itself, was it?
No, this is a power plant.
This is just the engine portion.
Right.
Okay.
And that was a very concerning point to me, because that led to an argument, which just about getting ready to ensue here. Because I get up to the point where it's damaged, and then the colonel asked me, could you explain to us exactly how the firing sequence occurs in this thing, especially at that damage point?
I would have said, wait till the guys come back from vacation, the guys that you built the thing, right?
Actually, I just cut to the chase. I just went, well, I'll tell you what. This thing isn't ours, and it's not theirs, the Soviets. As a matter of fact, it's not even from the neighborhood, is it? I said, where is this thing originating from? And I asked him, I said, this is a power plant. It came out of a very large craft. Can you tell me where the craft is? It probably had a crew. Where is the crew? Have you pickled those people? And I said, on top of that, I don't know how old this is. Did you guys find this thing digging out this big cave? And another thing, what'd you do with all the dirt? You ever thought about that?
And you're just like going crazy.
Yeah, I'm just now, it's all pent up, and I'm going, and everyone's questions are real uncomfortable. And I'm going, and somebody explained to me, how's this damn lights work in this place? And I said, there's something going on here, and I tell you, I've seen enough already. I am totally pissed off because you people are setting on something that everybody on the planet should know. And what are you trying to do? Are you trying to reverse engineer this thing? Do you want me to sit here and try to tell you how this thing works? Obviously, you can't figure it out. I have a similar design. You're trying to figure out how in the world did I ever get this far with it. So now you got me and my rocket up on the desert floor up here, and now we're on your base. And I said, well, just exactly what are the intentions here? And, well, that's when everybody started getting angry.
At you.
Yeah.
They're not fighting amongst each other?
No, it's like an oops thing.
Yeah.
And except Rudolph is smiling.
Now, at this point, has it crossed your mind that this could be extraterrestrial?
Oh, not even could be. It absolutely is. There's no way in God's earth we could have built anything like this. The manufacturing process was completely out of our grasp. There's nothing in existence. Even in the black op operations, except that facility had things going on like I just couldn't explain.
Well, David, I've got to ask you, where was the rest of the craft?
I have no idea. I never found out. And a better question, were the occupants?
Oh, and the occupants.
I'd like to know more about that. And
was this part of the Roswell crash? Who knows?
Yeah.
I don't think those craft were that big, though.
Did they shoot it down, or did they find it digging it up? Is it a few years old? Is it a million or several billion years old? You don't know. There's so much there you don't know. All you do know is it doesn't belong to us, and they're trying to figure out how it works. And they obviously didn't. It doesn't belong to us, or they wouldn't keep asking me fundamental questions of how the thing works on a simple fundamental principles. They can't even get the internal combustion thoughts right. And I'm sitting there going, my God, what they're trying to do is reverse this thing and try to figure out, going piece by piece, if they can figure out how it was built to begin with.
Now, at this point, do you have any idea how this works?
I had some clues, yeah, because working on my own, I learned fundamental principles because, like I said earlier, a Cessna 150 and a 747 will fly on the same principles.
If our planet evolved at a certain pace, this engine that you saw might have come out of what year on this planet?
I haven't a clue.
3,000? 2,500?
It could have been. I have no idea what the the breakdown rate of this of the hull of the metal is.
But, I mean, how many years do you think this group that invented this might have been ahead of us?
Wherever they might be. Oh, my God.
Thousands of years?
Millions.
Millions, okay.
Millions. Probably hundreds. Because there's a lot more to these engines than just... It's a power plant. See what I'm doing. I'm just as guilty as the rest of military humans or whatever. Yeah, I can only do the easy approach to the technology. When we had atomic energy, what's the first thing we did with it? We blew a big hole in the ground.
Yep.
Okay. Well, what I'm trying to do is do a burst with this engine. I'm trying to get one of it to push through, simple Newtonian physics. Let's see if I can make the thing push itself through space. But that's not what these things do. They do far greater, better things. I'm just trying to get the mass. I am an alphabet. I'm trying to understand the alphabet.
These things go through portholes, don't they?
Oh, man. Let me give you an example of what it can do. In phase one, I'm trying just to get the mass and get the containment field to close. I never got the containment field to close on mine. I could only get it for a few seconds.
On yours?
On mine. I could only get it to hold for a few seconds. Now, a few seconds don't sound like much, but I'll be kind of smug about it because NASA has spent billions of dollars, and they're in only a millionth of a fraction of 1 second. So my math was a little bit better, so I was able to close the field. But the problem is, if you could see my math and the way the algorithms run, it runs on a consensus of a Mobius, if you know what a Mobius is.
I have no idea.
Okay, let's see. Imagine taking a Nautilus. You know what a Nautilus is?
Yep.
Okay, and turn it inside out. That's what a Mobius looks like.
Okay.
And with this layer on a curve of a curvature of a curvature, with each of the advancing math on the algorithms of the models as they extend out, I can close the thing till I get it to make a complete loop where you can close it. The problem is I can't do enough of the repetition and enough of the inversions that requires on the calculations. The bottom line is the fastest computer speed we got is like a 1 gigahertz. I would need a 200 gigahertz speed computer to try to get this field to close.
It's got to be frustrating you.
Oh, man, it's like you know how to build a Corvette and you're back in 1860 and you're trying to use all the tools around there and it's just not working. But you know it can be done. But the thing is, once the Mobius is closed and we get the math on this thing, then that's phase one. Phase two is where you start building the secondary fields. if you could see this thing, the gravity field of the chamber looks like a stack of donuts. And in the center is where the engine sets, or in this case, on a second field, is where the spacecraft would sit. And then what happens when that happens is amazing.
David, do you think the engine, that power plant, is still there at Area 51?
Oh, I'm pretty certain it is, because I think they have a lot of other infrastructures, and as advanced that base is built, it's probably the best lab they've got.
David, I might have to get you back for part two of this program, huh?
Maybe.
Now I know what you meant.
Oh, we hadn't, remember the list, if you saw the list of questions I sent you?
Uh-huh. Well, we haven't even gotten into any of them.
No, the top 10 of those, I mean, look at the first 10. That's about all the projects I've been working on that I wanted to fill everybody in on. And speaking of everybody, all these emails I get, there's just no way I can answer the emails. It's just, I wouldn't even have time to go to the bathroom.
And, you'd be doing this for the rest of your life.
I know, but I don't want to offend people or seem rude or
Why don't we do this? Why don't we, the next time we get you back, also open it up, because we're not going to have time to take calls, which I normally do. Why don't we do a program with some calls and people can just chat with you? You want to do that?
That would be nice, because a lot of the people deserve a shot at me, good or bad, because but a lot of them have really wrote some really nice stuff. And you know, an excellent point on that is my writer that helped me write this script of the story we just went over.
Mm-hmm.
And he was talking to Stanton Freeman, and Stanton Freeman said, well, wait a minute, how could he have done all that? Because he would need access to vacuum chambers and all that stuff. And prior to all this, I hadn't told my writer friend any of this. And when he told me that, and I told him, wow, that really pleases me. Stanton Freeman is a smart man. He can actually ask the right questions. He's right.
Oh, we'll do that. We'll schedule you on another date just for phone calls from people.
Yeah, I would like to do that.
I want to tell you, somebody sent me some info. He listens to the Coast to Coast religiously.
Uh-huh.
He's got what he's called a voice analyzer, and he tells me, George, this guy's telling the truth. This guy isn't. I want you to know that he has told me beyond a shadow of a doubt, he says David Adair is telling the truth.
Oh, my God.
And I just wanted you to know that, because when we went into this discussion, you were talking about credibility and how important that was to you.
Well, it's just, you know, it is, but it isn't, because people, you know, I don't owe critics anything. I'm not selling books, not selling tapes. I'm not asking for your blessings. You know, I don't have to explain anything. And on top of that, it's proprietary laws out here. The name of my rocket, told Art Bell, there's a name on my rocket called Pithlum. Well, I can't even get Pithlum on the Internet because somebody heard me say it and they captured it in the domain. And I'm sitting there going, see what I'm talking about? I don't need this. You know, I really don't. And
yeah, I know what you mean.
But there are really good people out there who are trying to sort through all the smoke and stuff and find out what's real and what's not. And I really feel for those people, and I really have to sometimes take time and sit. And I totally understand how Bob Lazar feels. You know, like, he don't want to talk to anybody. And I do believe he has all the earmarks of somebody who went through the real thing.
How do you feel about the fact that we might have this reversed engineered technology, we might have alien craft, we might have alien bodies, and the American people really haven't been officially told about it yet?
Well, I think, like I told the people when we get back to the, that's where the fight started. And, man, I am so furious. It's like, nobody has a right to contain that kind of information. No damn government on the planet, nobody can sanction that kind of withheld on the information, because it affects every human being on the planet. We've all got a right to know this stuff.
Is that why you're not living in this country anymore?
I'm a little pissed, yeah. And not only that, the type of work I'm doing now, I need access to nuclear material. And since 9/11, it's like, are you kidding? But in the rest of the world, they're not so paranoid-driven like entire America is. You got nothing but fear-based media. The 6 o'clock news is nothing but 45 minutes of rape, kill, murder, mayhem, carjackings, and you should be afraid of everything. And in Canada, they never even lock their damn doors up there.
Oh,
nobody locks their doors.
I know that.
And you know, where I'm at, and I'm not there yet. I'm still going. I'm moving in the.
Hold on. Let me lock my studio door here.
But where I'm at, we don't even have doors. We haven't even got doors on the place yet. So, and I'm not worried about anything. It's just that's the thing. People live in such fear, and I'm telling y'all, you don't have to live that way. All the stuff I've been through, do I sound like I'm fear-ridden? And my God, I've been in the belly of the beast and back out.
I still wish you were in this country again.
Well, I can do more for America and its people outside than I can from the inside.
All right.
And it's I'll come back in. I've just got a lot of just going to get. You know how the farmers were with the facility?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I've got a better farm. But I'll be back in occasionally. Stuff. I've got to come back in and have an operation. I get my spinal column put back together.
Oh my gosh!
And that's something you should pass on to Art Bell. Tell him to look up a thing called spineonline.com.
Okay, he's feeling better now.
Yeah, well, he'll feel really better if you check with these people.
All right.
They can completely rebuild a spinal column, and you walk home the same day. I discovered them on Discovery Health Channel. And it's Dr. David Stithworth, and he's in Beverly Hills.
They're going to reverse engineer you, David.
Probably.
Would you, Coach, you never saw the bodies, did you?
No. It was too much of an argument. And you got to understand what was happening at that moment. I was yelling at them. They tell me to get down off the engine. I start to get down off the engine. I'm really angry because this is just a betrayal to no end. And my world is coming apart. I had an American flag that I slept with for a blanket. You know, I did listen to Anita Bryant. And this was just, now everything is shattering right in front of me. And it's just like you feel like you've been totally betrayed by your own people you trusted. And so I'm getting down off the engine, and as I'm grabbing hold of the engine, you remember the nice blue-white cascading?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It now looks like flames from a volcano ripping down through its side.
What's causing that?
As I'm looking at that, and I'm angry, right? And as I see that, and I'm hanging on to the engine, I'm going down, I start looking at it and trying to figure out what's doing it. And I'm calming down. As I calm down, it starts turning from red back to blue.
Don't tell me it's picking up on your moods.
It's absolutely, and it's not just mood, it's a lot deeper. This thing is a symbiotic engine, and it's alive, and it's ascension, and it's totally aware that you're there, and it is not dead, and it is still operating even with this damaged area, and at least the secondary functions of its cognitive function systems are still working. Its synaptic order is still in place. And I'm sitting there going, oh, my God, out here I thought it was heat recognition from thermal radiation, when actually it is more on a telepathy level. This thing is able to blend with its own occupants. And the greatest way to fly through space is in a symbiotic state. That's where the crew would hook up to the craft. The craft is hooked up to the power plant, and all three of them are hooked up as a symbiotic relationship.
Almost like the various pieces of an ant, for example.
Absolutely. It is the most powerful structure you could possibly imagine, and if in one part of it could be damaged, the rest of it is still functional.
Yep.
And I'm sitting there going, my God. I went, that is that, and we built this. Oh, come on, give me a break.
Have you seen the movie Core, C-O-R-E?
Yes, I have.
That machine that they built to go down into the center of the earth is exactly now what you've said. It's almost as if they know what you've been saying, because it's a new movie.
Yeah.
And because that whole craft could separate and still function.
Yeah. Oh, man, I have been dissected by this Hollywood studios. The last 3 years, to think half the stuff you got, you've been watching, I would sit down with the studios and gave it to them. And man, if that's the case, which it is, there's a lot of more neat stuff coming out you're going to see.
Oh, that's exciting. That really is. How do you feel about the fact that we might have been visited?
Oh, and that's a good way to phrase it, fact. Yeah, we've been visited. I think we're still being visited. You know, the question is, what is the protocol that's going on here? You know, why isn't there a massive contact? And God knows everybody in the metaphysical world's got 1,000 reasons, right?
Yeah.
And I don't know. I'm just a mere mortal man here with a brain that works only half the time. So I don't know why the protocol.
Your half is more than my full. What are you talking about?
Oh, man. My wife and I, we always kid each other. We tell people, we're the moron twins. We're not even twins. So, but anyway, I don't know that if we may be in a study program, my God, we could be an experiment. I mean, there's a million variables, but the thing is, there's no way that we're alone. And they say that we're out on the backwash of the universe, which we are on the very outer end of the spiral arm, and the vast distances in Newtonian physics that you can't do it. But, you know, this engine I was telling you about, phase two would take care of that entire problem.
It has been now 32 years since you were down there at Area 51.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think in 32 years they have figured out how that engine works?
I don't think so. I really don't. Because they got the same infrastructure problem as I do. They don't have the computer speeds to retrack everything. It'd be like trying to take a F-14 apart back in 12th century. You know, you can hack and beat it all apart. It's not going to tell you much. You can hack it into pieces. You don't have the sophistication to know how to even take the thing apart.
If they asked you to come back and look at this engine again, because 32 years have gone by, you've grown up, you've learned more, would you go back there? Would you try to figure it out?
If they drag the thing out into a public square where everybody could watch me work on it, yeah, I would do that.
You would do that. But,
absolutely.
But not down where it is. Okay.
Not again. And, yeah, if everybody could sit out on a big platform, invite everybody else in, we all work at it together, yeah, I would join in on that. And I'd be glad to. But I'm not doing any of this stuff in secrecy like that. That is just, it's horrendous. It never was meant for us to be like that. And, you know, it's just, one thing I wanted to finish on a thought.
Yeah, go ahead.
Phase two of the engine. You've got to listen to this. What this engine can do, if you build a secondary field outside the craft while the internal field is setting on the engine, you'll get this double effect, look like two sets of donuts. And what will happen if you can see that, it can do this. You can pick a designated point in space. Let's say we want to go to Andromeda Galaxy, 200 million light years away, at 186,756.4 miles per second speed of light. It would take you 200 million years to get there. Well, guess what? We live 70 years old. That ain't going to hack it.
Mm-mm.
So we got to figure out a way. But we got a thing called Newtonian physics, which is you can't blow it off like it doesn't exist, you know, in science fiction. Okay, here's quandary, riddle. How do you go millions of times faster than the speed of light without breaking the speed of light and remaining in the consistent Newtonian physics?
You fold it.
Exactly. It will roll up like a burrito. And if you squeeze the burrito and look at the edge on a linear surface plane, that's how far you'd have to travel at a light speed, three-quarter light speed, whatever. Then in just a couple minutes of our real time, you shut the engines off, and now you went 200 million light years, millions of times faster than the speed of light, and you didn't even break the speed of light.
Not at all. And that's how they got here.
Yeah, and that's how it got here, or whatever they, who they, whatever. And that's how they keep going. Also, the secondary fields inside, when I was doing my math, I found a little quirk, which this quirk is very cool. This thing has an inertia dampener field. Do you know what that is?
Mm-mm.
It means this. It means that you could come streaking in our atmosphere, in our gravity field, do a 10,000-mile, 9-degree corner, and at that speed, you would look like liquid. You'd be soup on the wall. But with an inertia dampener field, inertia does not exist in that sphere of influence. And the way you describe that is a scenario of a fly in a car. The car is doing 100 miles an hour down the road, right? The fly is flying around inside the car, not touching anything. Is the fly doing 100 miles an hour?
Yes, I guess.
In a three-dimensional plane on a three-dimensional universe on a straight and true lateral plane, yes, it is moving that fast. Now, the car smashes into the wall. The fly is not touching anything. And if no debris hits him, what happens to the fly? Does he crash into the wall? Does debris hit him? Or is it, you know, what happens to the fly if he's not touching anything?
That's my quiz question. And I've been doing so well tonight, too.
Yes, you have. I'll give you a star anyhow.
I don't think anything happens to the fly.
Well, he'll be killed. He'll smash into the wall because he's still inside the inertia field, which is a sphere of influence.
I lost that question.
Okay.
Nine out of ten's not bad, David.
No, it's not. And here's the next part. You'll like this to the answer. It's a two-part answer. Now, go back to, we're about the same age, go back to Bugs Bunny, and there was a favorite cartoon of mine where he's in an airplane, and it starts crashing to Earth, and it's going so fast, the wings ripping off, and they're all screaming to the top of their lungs, and the Earth is coming at them, and they're all going to die, right?
Yeah.
And right before the craft hits the ground, Bugs opens the door and steps outside, and the airplane folds up like aluminum foil, and he's fine.
He's fine.
And everybody laughs, right? That's not a joke. That's exactly how an inertia dampener field would work. And I'm sitting there going, we learned it from a cartoon. Isn't that great?
So what are you doing now?
Well, what I'm doing now is I'm trying to get everything rounded up, and I'm scattered to the four winds right now. But I'm trying to get everything down to the island so I can get everything started down there. And I'm going, I've got, the first thing I got to do is, which is what all those other questions have on the sheet in front of you, I've got to get back to microgravity processing. And that's where I can do with, I'm building some really large rockets that will go just at the edge of space and they'll free fall back here. I'll get 25 minutes of weightless environment.
Who funds you?
I'm doing it myself.
Self-funding.
Well, no, that's the whole key to this thing. You control yourself. I guess I did well in projects and also with my investments weren't too bad. So everything worked out.
Yeah, because I guess in only the few moments we still have left. So what happened from the 13-year-old David Adair to where he is now? I mean, I guess you had a pretty darn good career, didn't you?
It wasn't too bad after I got through with military because they weren't through with me at Area 51, and they ended up taking 10 years of my life because I ended up spending 10 years in the Navy as the barter with. There's more to the story.
Well, you're a Navy man, too, like I was.
Oh, yeah, where are you Navy?
Oh, really? 9 years.
Oh, yeah, where at?
9 years, Defense Information School, a little Pensacola action.
And what's your billet?
I was a 1655.
Okay, yep. My God. Well, I started out as an ADJ. Jet engine tech.
Sure.
And
that was way beyond my mind at the time.
Then I went through with that. I ended up becoming a DV, diver. And then on top of that, I got transferred to O&I.
That's something. Well, David, the clock is ticking, but I want to do this and because I think for our listeners and those who have enjoyed you for so long, we'll schedule something at your convenience. I'll get Lisa to get a hold of you.
Okay.
And we'll do a program. We'll do a real brief update of just what's going on with you, but we'll do a program for you and the Coast to Coast listeners. Just you two can chat.
That would be nice.
And
I really appreciate all the people's kind comments. And I still get them. 3 years later, they're still writing me a lot. And, I'm flattered. I just don't want to leave people hanging. They think I'm rude or I'm stuck up. And I don't. It's just, you know, just so many of y'all out there, and there's one of me, you know. And I really, really feel bad about that. And I would like to be able to talk to everybody at one time. I'd like to sit down all evening with every one of them, but just can't do it.
And I guess flying saucers coffee isn't all that bad either, is it?
No, it's not. And you can reach me. And if you do write to my website, rest assured, I will read every email there is. I never miss them. I always read them all. And sometimes in extreme cases, I'll make an exception to answer. But, boy, there's just so many of them. But I really like reading what people have to say in their comments. And some of them have come up with really good ideas.
And, you know, somewhere along the line, there could be some 13-year-old youth who sends you a fascinating comment, and he might have some information you could use.
I'm just alluding to that. Some of the ideas that have been thrown at me on the emails has sent my brain spinning in another direction because sometimes the forest for the trees.
We'll set this up, David. In the meantime, you have a good Thanksgiving next month, okay?
Well, I sure appreciate that.
All right, you take care of yourself.
All right, George.
He's out there on an island somewhere doing what he does. For Steve Carr, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Barbara Simpson, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM.